What if this isn't a climate crisis, but the greatest opportunity humanity has had in a long time? Lean Into Clean will explore and discuss with highly esteemed guests on what could be the new spirals for society, sustainability, spirituality, and social harmony. Perhaps we've all lost our way. Lean Into Clean will showcase how we might remember, refocus and restore the natural ways so we can again live in balance and harmony with life on Earth and all its inhabitants. Welcome to this week's Lean Into Clean. I'm Jarvis Smith. This is UK Health Radio. Lean Into Clean is a show where we explore the ideas, the people and the movement shaping a better world from the inside out. But today, before I introduce you to today's guest, who I'm super excited to be speaking to, I am recording or doing this show, should I say, from New York. We are live from New York, which is amazing. I'm over here for a really big week, actually. On the 22nd of this week, which is Wednesday, it's Earth Day, which has been a global movement that's been going on since 1970. It's a really monumental day. This year's Earth Day, people of all backgrounds and generations are called to stand shoulder to shoulder in defense of the only home we share. So you can join people on Earth Day by going to the Earth Day website, which is earthday.org. We also have an amazing event in Times Square in partnership with OMM. Many of you will remember OMM, O-M-M-M. We've had loads of ambassadors. I'm an ambassador. We've actually got an ambassador on the show today, which is super, super, super exciting. So this week is going to be a big monumental week. And actually, today's guest has personally invited me to participate in speaking at a UN event as part of the Indigenous Forum, which is a huge week where the UN celebrates the Indigenous communities. And this particular week is focused around Indigenous communities and linked to conflict, which, of course, there is so much of that going on in the world today. I'm not going to spoil it too much because I want today's guest to actually tell us a little bit more about it. But it's going to be super exciting. So I'm super pleased to be. It's 8 o'clock in the morning here. So that just shows you that we're 5 hours behind the UK, which is fantastic. So let's get on with this. So today's guest is one of those rare humans who bridges education, culture, peace, and real-world action. Rebecca Irby is the founding partner and president of the PEAK Institute, an organization working at the intersection of peace, education, cross-cultural understanding, and heart-led leadership, which we all love on this show. And over the past decade, she's advised institutions from the New Jersey Department of Education to Rutgers University, worked internationally with organizations like the Red Cross, Toyota and Mitsubishi, and even developed cross-cultural communication frameworks for the Japanese Ministry of Economy, Trade and Industry. But this isn't just theory. Rebecca's work lives in the real world, from producing a powerful documentary telling the story of Hiroshima survivor to organizing a 500-kilometer endurance ride through areas devastated by the 2011 tsunami, to taking youth voices directly into global policy spaces, including the United Nations and Nuclear Non-Proliferation Forum. She's spoken at some of the world's most influential institutions, Harvard Law School, Yale, Global Peace Forums, and her work centers on something we don't talk about enough. What does it really mean to lead from the heart in a world that desperately needs healing? Rebecca, welcome to Lean Into Clean.
Oh my goodness, Jarvis. Thank you so much for that beautiful introduction. As you were saying all of those things, it's like, who is that? Oh my goodness, that's me.
It's hard, isn't it? When you're listening back about yourself, you're kind of, is there anything missing from that bio? Is there anything you think, oh, I wish I'd said this, or I wish people knew this about me? Anything you'd like to add?
That I'm really starting to incorporate and bring in my whole self. So we're talking about heart-centered leadership, but I think one of the really important pieces of that is including healing in our work. And that's something that I've been doing more recently, integrating my whole self. So I would say that that's the only thing I would add is how important and critical healing is and how beautiful it's been over the last few years to really be able to incorporate that into my practices and my work.
I love that. I love, because actually I think that's probably the thing that brought you and I together. That's the bit that kind of made us want to support each other and work together, which we are beginning to do in many ways right now, which is fantastic. So let's get the energy flowing. So let's look at your origin story. Let's start at the beginning. What was the moment or series of moments that set you on this path toward peace and education and cross-cultural understanding? Where did it all begin?
Was a little bit of an odd child. I've always been very, I guess, cerebral and thinking a lot. I always wanted to know what was happening and what was going on. I was deeply connected to other people's pain and sorrow, even from a very young age. And I would tell my mother that I could tell that there were children hurting around the world and I wanted to help them. And she didn't understand where I knew that. And I was just like, I know, I can feel them. I know that there are kids that need our help. And it wasn't here in this country, it was kids around the world. And even though my mother was a single parent with two children, my older sister has a very a rare disability and disease. It's called Rett syndrome. So my mom had spent most of my life pouring into my sister and figuring out what that was. When my sister was diagnosed there, we didn't know what it was. So there was just a lot of time in my life spent thinking and wondering and kind of tapping into the feelings around me and the world around me. And it was because as I was growing and seeing things that were happening, there was a tree. And this is when I was 4 years old, and they were putting in a new shopping center in my little suburb, and they were going to cut down this tree. And it was my favorite tree. And I wanted to go and protest. So I convinced my mother that we would go and stand, and I would climb the tree and I would sit in the tree and I wouldn't let them cut it down.
Wow.
I was 4 years old.
What an activist at four. That's impressive.
Long story short, we saved the tree for a day.
Nice.
The town was. They were pretty upset, but they were like, okay, we won't cut it down today. But as soon as I got out of the tree for the evening and the
Yeah.
next day, it went forward. But it was that moment of seeing all of these construction workers and the town and everybody stop because I was sitting in the tree and they weren't going to cut it down. And I think as a very young human and soul, it was the first moment that I realized how powerful we are if we can come together and use our voice and try and protect things that are important to us. And I really carried that lesson with me throughout my life, and it's something I think about often when people ask me how I got my start. And it's really standing up for the beings and the things on our planet that don't have a voice. Actually, I'm gonna take that back. They do have voices. It's just that we choose not to hear them. So it's for me, it's about remembering and coming back to being able to truly listen to what's going on and understand the healing that is needed and how we can help that. and helping that forward.
Absolutely amazing. I mean, that's remarkable. I just got, as you were speaking, I just got this vision of you as a 4-year-old in this tree. It was a super powerful image. Thank you for that. Absolutely beautiful. Tell us about the current spot that you're in. So kind of, really winding fast forward to this moment. So Peak
Stepping through
Institute.
time.
Yes, exactly. Let's move through time quickly, and we'll probably
Yes.
dart back and forth. But so Peak Institute, for those hearing about it for the first time, what is the core mission of Peak? And that's PEAC for those that are wondering what Peak is, Institute. And what change are you really here to create in the world? Give us your Peak life's purpose.
Yes, so PEAC stands for Peace, Education, Art, and Culture. The C actually changes from time to time. So sometimes it's representing culture, sometimes it's representing community, sometimes communication, but we really like to lean into all of that because it's really critical. I would say PEAC Institute is at the intersection of peace building, justice, global citizenship, and I'm looking for a new world, a new word for citizenship, actually. So if the audience can help us send in some language to talk about our human race. There are so many people in our world that don't have quote unquote citizenship. So I'm looking for a new word for that. But PEAC really sits at that intersection of bringing people together and what true transformational change is, how we get there, and what it looks like. I would say my work takes me into international spaces, the United Nations, and these really big conversations. But at the end of the day, it's actually the small interpersonal conversations that make the biggest change. And it's those intimate connections, heart to heart, that actually make the change. Even in negotiating rooms, even at policy sessions, it's not the policy, it's not the facts and figures that make what we need to see. It's when we connect to someone's heart. So it's through stories and it's through lived experiences. And that's such a critical part of this work. So combining policy work that's really critical, and that takes study, that takes research. As a researcher, I love that space and it's so exciting. But being able to translate what you do in the lab into real life takes real like that's where the real work is, translating from theory into true practice and what it is with like real humans in real space. So I like to play in the liminal space, all of the in-betweens, and that's where the magic happens.
Lovely. I love the way that you've articulated that, because I mean, there's so many scientific observations now that, when people are listening to facts, their kind of brain just literally kind of shuts down. But when they're hearing a story, using the same facts, but it's told in a storytelling way, people actually really engage, fully holistically with it. Let's talk a little bit about your kind of heart-centered leadership, because you absolutely strike me that you operate from the heart, you operate with integrity, you operate w in service to something other than yourself. Which is remarkable. There are very few people, certainly leaders out there that we can ob observe that are kind of leading in that way. I would perhaps say it's a relatively feminine way of leadership, and I don't even mean that to be disrespectful at all, but it's a softer, more powerful way. But what is your version of heart-centered leadership? What does that mean to you?
You're right. It's ground in indigenous theory and knowledge, and it is more feminine in the, if we look at how countries are organized and we talk about this idea of feminine and masculine. And for me, I believe that it's really necessary to have both. So we need that theory, we need the hard facts, but For me, it's about balance, right? So when we bring together the masculine and the feminine, for me, that's where transformation actually happens. And it's what our cultures for thousands of years, millennia, have been trying to get to. We keep flip-flopping. There's one group that gets into control and they're scared of their power and they try to control everything and everyone. And then we get a paradigm shift because people don't want to be controlled. We have free spirits. We don't want to feel like we're in cages. No one should and no one needs to. So my work, I ask three questions always, and this helps keep me grounded and keep it heart-centered. So when we're talking about policy, when we're talking about changes that we want to see, I'm constantly asking, okay, who is benefiting from this change? Who is going to be harmed from this change? And who have we completely forgotten and isn't even at the table that this is going to impact? And if we think about it in that way and we answer these questions and we understand that it's not a zero-sum game, it's not that if I win, Jarvis has to lose, it's that we can both win. And it is incumbent upon us as leaders to find that way. So I go into negotiations at the United Nations in the Security Council. We're talking about, people talk about negligible percentages. And what I like to do is say, okay, if there's someone, we have young people coming in and they're like, well, if this is going to impact and it's going to have such a huge positive impact for 90% of the population. I'm like, okay, but that 10%, those are still humans. And your equation does not compute because 10% fail rate is not big enough. 2%, it's not okay. So I bring in those people who it's impacting negatively. And I say to the lawmakers and to those making policy, okay, tell this child that they don't matter. They're in that 2% that you're saying doesn't matter. Tell them to their face that they don't matter and that their stories don't count. And negotiations, I will have to say, change dramatically when you have the people who are impacted in the room to tell their stories, not to tell facts and figures, but to truly connect heart to heart. And that helps us understand we can find solutions that include everyone, that work for everyone. It's not a zero-sum game.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's such a broad perspective, and you're right. Most, I guess, what would they be called? But let's say meetings. Most meetings are trying to deal with the very subject matter, and often that's blinkered or there were blind spots. So I love that broad perspective. Thank you. That's actually taught me a different way of thinking about things as well. Appreciate it. What are you working on at the moment? What's the big drive for your heart right now?
Yes. So I was just appointed to the co-NGO board at the United Nations, and it's a 5-year appointment, and we each get an assignment for our 5 years, and I was assigned creating a learning academy for the United Nations and specifically for CoNGO. So CoNGO stands for the Conference of Non-Governmental Organizations in Consultative Status at the United Nations, because the UN, we love our acronyms. But
I tell you
basically
what,
what, yeah.
let's hold it there because I think that's a really lovely introduction to what we can talk about after this very, very quick commercial break. Don't go away. We're going to be back
Perfect.
with Rebecca Erbe in just a few minutes.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment, we explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, here we go. Back with Rebecca Irby. Sorry about that, but you were just telling us about your newly recently appointed position with the UN. So just give us a little bit more perspective. And also for anybody that's just tuned in, I'm here with Rebecca Irby, who's founder of the Peak Institute. And we're in New York, which is super exciting. We're going to be actually meeting in person for the first time today. How exciting.
Yes, it's very exciting. So many people I've been working with for years that I'm going to be meeting for the first time. It's international and multilateral work is very exciting. And sometimes you'll work with people for a decade and you won't meet them in person. Yeah. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, well, I'm really looking forward to it. Let's go back to this this new position that you've got, which is, I mean, it sounds incredible. I'm really interested in the change making work you're going to be doing.
Yes, so I'm really, really proud and excited about that. And this is the youngest board that has ever been elected. It's the most diverse board that has ever been elected. And my cohort, those of us that were just elected, it's a really proud moment. So for the first time, we have an organization from Africa, we have an organization from the Middle East represented on the board, and it's just really exciting to be a part of this really big change in history and in the way that the United Nations is moving. So what we are charged with, and the entire board, not just the section that I'm working on, is really modernizing the rules and how we engage. And we're thinking about this as what I'm dubbing the UN of the people. So right now, it's a lot of the United Nations is heavily focused on countries, and that's where it started. Yeah. But there's a whole body of NGOs, which stands for non-governmental organizations. Yeah. And that's where civil society, nonprofits, were the actual work that the UN does. And I think a lot of people are unfamiliar with the UN system. First, it's a membership organization. So you have to pay dues in order to be a member. That's NGOs and countries. So all of this work that is done, people who are doing it aren't getting paid. They are paying to do it and to be there. That's the first thing. The second thing is, in my opinion, the countries that are there have forgotten their purpose. They make themselves very important, and I feel as though they've forgotten that they are there to represent the people, mm-hmm. and specifically the NGOs that are actually doing all of the work on the ground. So it's been very unbalanced, and what our board and all of our members, there's 20 of us from different organizations and countries around the world, and our what we're going to be working on for the next 5 years is really making this the decade of the people, of the UN for the people, getting everyday people, NGOs, the volunteers, all of the people who do the work to have a much larger voice and be much more involved through the processes. And in order to do that, we decided education, and it, you know, that's my area. I love that space, and I think it's just so critical and important. But we're going to be creating a learning academy, also a placeholder name at the moment, but really looking at three different pillars. So citizen journalism, again, looking for new names, but citizen journalism, global citizenship, and then impact for nonprofits. We're really trying to move away from the word nonprofit and talk about it as impact and this impact space and moving towards that. So
love it.
Programs love to it. Support all of that.
That's amazing. I mean, thank you for, you know, stepping into one of the world's biggest bureaucracies. I hope I can call it that. I mean, the UN
is. Yes, it is. Imagine just a university and the bureaucracy that is there and then multiply that by over 190 for each country. And then, it is absolutely the world's largest bureaucracy.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I love the fact that you're in and more importantly, committed to it, because it's, you know, it's not for the faint-hearted. These positions are not for people that are not absolutely, truly committed, purpose-driven, North Star-driven, you know, have to feel supported, even though you might not be getting actual support. It's like, you know, it's an amazing step. So, you know, I'm with you. I am, you know, committed to walking alongside you and supporting you in any way that I can. So thank you for that. I'd like to talk a little bit about I'd like to, you know, culture and communication, because I find you to be remarkable at communicating culture. But before we do that, I always ask my guests to bring us a couple of songs that are, you know, soundtracks to their life's work. You have come with a couple of crackers. Tell us what song you're going to play first and why you chose it, please. I think the timing is absolutely perfect, by the way, of this one.
Well, thank you. And I have to tell you, when you asked me that, I was like, oh my God, a soundtrack for my life's work? Nobody has asked me that. And I took it very seriously. So I really went through and tried to come up with two songs that I feel really encompass my life's work and then also this moment that we are currently in. So my first song is A Change Is Gonna Come by Sam Cooke. It was actually the very, when you first said that, I was like, okay, that one is absolutely my first song. It just feels like it encompasses the work that I do in justice and dignity and belief, but it also holds pain and possibility. And I think anytime we're doing justice work, there is always that juxtaposition of pain and possibility. And the possibility part is so critical. And I believe that that's what we need right now. We have to acknowledge the pain that we're in, but we have to understand that it's when we come together in community, that's where the hope and the possibility lies.
I love it. A Change Is Gonna Come by Sam Cooke.
Like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me, no. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother, and I say, brother, help me, please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Oh, there have been times that I thought I couldn't last for long. But I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Oh, thank you for choosing that song. Absolutely.
I love that song so much. It speaks to my heart so deeply.
Yeah, lovely. It spoke to mine too. Thank you. I haven't had that song in a while. So, and you know what? It's such an emotional song, because we all know the changes that need to happen in the world today. And we all, you know, it seems like every single person I've ever met or speaks to wants a better life for, you know, themselves and the people around them. And you've really committed to that. I want to talk a little bit about your multiculturalism, because you are, you know, probably one of the most multicultural people that I've met. Not only do you embody it, i.e. you are, you know, multicultural within you. You can tell us a bit about that and how that's informed your place in the world. But you've worked across many cultures, from, you know, America to Japan. What are the biggest misunderstandings you see between cultures today, and how do we begin to bridge them? Because you have definitely done that within yourself. How does that translate to others?
It's a beautiful question, and it's something I do a lot of trainings on this, because I realized very young that it was something that I embodied. And as you said, I am a multi-ethnic human myself, so I just live it, and I've had to navigate that my entire life. So I am, my father's side of the family is Jamaican and Native American, Mohawk, and my mom's side of the family is Indonesian and Dutch. And so I have two very distinct families, and they are very different from each other. And I happened to not really fit on either side. I was always a little bit too dark for my white family, and always a little too light for my black family. And everyone always had something to say about everything, from my hair to just the way that I looked, to my color, my complexion. There's just always something that didn't quite fit, and that people would pick on or like point out as I was growing up. And that gave me a place of observation. I didn't really feel like I belonged. I didn't feel like I had a community or that I fit anywhere. So it's just always kind of observing. I talk about the liminal space because I feel like that's where I exist. And it was having to learn how to navigate that as a human. I get asked. When my hair is in braids, right now it's in braids, so people don't ask me. When my hair is curly, people constantly, just random strangers walking down the street, will come up to me and ask me, and not in a, let me let people know, it is rude to ask somebody, what are you? That is not the way that you ask about someone's ethnicity or nationality, but people come up to me and they'll say, "Hey, like, what are you? I heard you speaking. I thought you were this. You don't sound that way. So I'm wondering what you are." And I'm like, "Wow, I'm a human. Who are you? Are you a human? Okay, cool." So that's kind of the background that got me into wanting to study culture, wanting to understand, and be really curious. So I bring that lens of curiosity to everything that I do. And that's how I teach folks about culture. And our cultures are very different. So different, sometimes they come back around and they meet, and we are so much the same. So there are universal truths that we all want. And it's understanding if we come from that place of curiosity about each other, about being a human, that's where we find our connection. And it's all of those differences that make it so much fun, so wonderful, and I say delicious, because that's what life is about, going out and exploring. So it's, yes. Cultures in Asia are very different. The way that we do presentations there, the way that we work there is going to be different. And it is incumbent upon us, if we are traveling, to know what that culture is like. So learning about it so that we can be curious and we don't make a cultural mistake. Like that's real. And there are lessons and we can learn that, but the biggest piece is just being curious about the other side, the other people, and not being beholden to our culture, being there to share it and to learn from one another. And that's been the biggest and most exciting part of the work that I get to do, is bringing people together. And my favorite way to do that is through food. It's such a shared culture, and we can truly learn so much about each other through the meals that we share with one another.
Yeah, nice. You've just reminded me about tell us a bit about the podcast that you did that was all about all around food, because I want to get into the media, the stuff, and we'll talk about the film that you made as well. But just tell us a little bit about that podcast and what it was called and how
Yeah,
people could find it.
that was called Power Shift. It is on Spotify, where you can find any of your other podcasts. And what I would do is bring in guests who were at the seat of power, making really big changes, and we would have a conversation over a meal. Side note, I am a terrible cook, so it was also trying to teach myself some new skills. So I would bring a guest in, they would send the recipe. This was during COVID, so we were not together in a studio. They would cook the meal in their house. I would attempt to cook it in my house. And then we would come together and we would eat it and we would share. I would share my like disaster in the kitchen, and then they would tell me about how it was actually supposed to be made and the culture behind it, where the spices come from. And then we would start to go from there, our family, our origins, our spices, and move into our life's work and how that impacted and has influenced us and where it brought us today. So it was called Power Shift, a seat at the table, at the dinner table.
I love it. I love it. I love it. I remember when you first told me about it, it's like, wow, that's such a cool concept. So do go and check it out. And I'm definitely going to do that. You've just reminded me of it. So fantastic. Let's talk about the film that you made. It's called That Day. But before we do that, we're just going to go to a very quick commercial break. We'll come back. So don't go away. We're going to hear about Rebecca's film that was all about Hiroshima. So see you in a sec.
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Great. So let's talk about your film That Day. It tells the story of a Hiroshima survivor.
Yes.
And how did that experience shape your perspective on peace, humanity, and the future?
Well, it really changed the trajectory of my life. I was working as an educator and a researcher in education when I met this survivor. So I was, as you mentioned, I was working in Japan. I was working on a cross-cultural course for the Japanese government. It was going into their aerospace program at their top universities. So I was working with Mitsubishi Heavy and Toyota and really feeling myself and was like, okay, I'm doing all of this big international work. I'm creating this curriculum. It was a dream come true. It was where I thought my life's work was going to continue. And as I was in Japan working, I decided it would be important to visit Hiroshima as an American. And I always loved studying. I think it's really important to study war. If we want to get to peace, it's really critical to understand how those situations came up. World War II being one of the largest. So it's something that I studied extensively. And it felt really important and critical to go there. So as I was there, it was really devastating. It was pretty soul shattering being there and understanding that what I had learned, and this is from childhood all the way through university and studying and doing research. As an educational researcher, I felt just so let down that the information I received and what I was studying wasn't the full truth. When you're there and you actually see it and you meet people and you speak to them and you understand the gravity of it, it's so radically different than especially what we learn in the United States. I can't speak to what folks learn across the globe around World War II, but in the United States, it's very short. It was 2 pages in my history book growing up. It was Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. We created a nuclear weapon. We bombed Japan. We annihilated them. We won the war. We are the victors of World War II. Amazing. America is the best.
Yeah.
In 2 pages in my history.
Biased, huh?
Just a little bit. Yeah. So being there and meeting this survivor. So I went through the park. I was really, as I said, I'm a very emotional being. So I was just sitting by the river and there's the epicenter. It's called the Gambaku Dome. And it's the iconic image from Hiroshima. I was sitting in front of it and just reflecting. I had tears coming down. I wasn't like hyperventilating. I was just sitting, I was crying. One of the survivors noticed and he came up to me, and very long story short, we connected and I decided as an educator, I would make a documentary and then make a curriculum about it to get the true story of Hiroshima and its impacts and the impacts of nuclear weapons out. And from that declaration, having never worked in media, never made a film, I've made curriculums. That was my strong suit. But it was really the film that kicked off and got my career, I suppose, in international relations, and that work kickstarted. I started to meet people who were involved with past treaties, and a bunch of us got together and just started talking one day. We were all pretty young. We were in our late 20s, early 30s, and we just started talking about like what would happen if we just went to all of our circles through our universities. We could pretty much canvass the entire globe. What if we just asked people if they wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons? Like, what would happen? And everyone told us we were insane. Like, that's not the way that things work. And we were like, well, I don't know. I think it could. I really think it could. So we started this campaign to abolish nuclear weapons. Nice. And everyone told us we were insane. Not only that we were insane, that we actually had no right to be in that space, that it was not for especially young women. It certainly wasn't for a bunch of teachers to be wading into this space that has to do with the military. So we worked on a treaty. I ended up becoming the international campaign manager for that initiative. And we collected millions. I want to say it was 14 million signatures by the end.
What?
But, yes. Wow. This was not me. This was a huge collective, 120 different organizations coming together to make this happen. And when we look at it, it appears that it happened overnight. It did not. We started in 2012. And by 2017, we had the treaty. We had brought it to the UN. It passed. Something that was categorically impossible to everyone. Wow. Not the Security Council, but the General Assembly. We had a super majority. So our treaty, it passed. And then we got it to enter into force, which is 50 countries around the world changed their constitutions to implement this treaty, which means that according to international law, nuclear weapons are now illegal. And we won the Nobel Peace Prize for that. We've divested $3.6 trillion from that industry. I know it looks like nothing has happened, but that's because these things take a long time for us to see the true impact. But the industry has switched from an investment industry to a liability industry. So there is no more capital going in. Now it's just insurance, and it can't hold. So within a few years, we're going to start seeing huge shifts, just like we did with biological weapons and chemical weapons. Nuclear weapons are finally at the same space in the world and treated the same as biological and chemical weapons. Illegal at this point, according to international law.
So. Wow, that is absolutely incredible. And I'm sure everybody listening is going to be taking a breath of relief by hearing that, particularly with all the geopolitical conflicts happening in the world today. Rebecca, I'm going to play your second song because would you believe we are 10 minutes away from the end of the show?
My
time
goodness.
Absolutely flies, I know. So we'll play your second song. When we come back after the song, I'd love to just hear a little bit about your take on, you know, what's happening now, what's going to be happening this week. And we can talk about, you know, possibly talk about some of the things that we're doing today, but we won't have long. So let's get your first song in. And your second song in, should I say. What are you playing next for us?
We are playing Rise Up by Andre Dre. Excuse me. And I'm realizing they're similar songs, but it feels like it really speaks to this moment that we're all living through. So I hope you enjoy.
I love it. I love this song. It's such a big, epic song. Thank you very much. This is Rise Up.
Broken down and tired of living life on the merry-go-round. And you can't find a fighter but I see it in you, so we gon' walk it out. Move mountains. We gon' walk it out and move mountains. And I'll rise up, I'll rise like the day. Silence is quiet, and it feels like it's getting hard to breathe. And I know you feel like dying, but I promise we would take the world to its feet. Move mountains, bring it to its feet. Move mountains. And I'll rise up, I'll rise like the day. I'll rise up, I'll rise unafraid. I'll rise up, and I'll do it a thousand times again. With you, with you, with you, with you. And for that we have each other.
Magical, magical. How does it feel listening to that song? What's your feeling state?
It's actually very emotional for me. It's a really personal song because of all of the things happening in my life and the season of my life at the moment. So I think it really speaks to the kind of leadership that I believe in, and choosing courage and healing and hope, even when the road is hard, even when there's so much going on, being able to choose community and collective power and collective care, I think is really, really important. And it's a beautiful reminder.
Thank you. Thank you for showing up. So let's talk a little bit about this week. So today we have the launch of the Indigenous Peoples Forum. On Wednesday, we've got Times Square, which you are going to be there. I'm going to be there. Anybody that wants to join in, it's the On Presents event that some of you will be familiar with. It's in Times Square. The Om section starts at 4 p.m. East time, and you can get that link at ompresents.com. So if you want to be with us from the UK, then you can do that. But Rebecca, please just give us an overview of this week for you.
Yeah, so there's actually multiple forums going on. There's Financing for Development. There is the Permanent Forum of Indigenous Issues going on. There's Earth Week going on. And this year, I am very excited and so proud that we were able to actually combine a bunch of these events, which in their 25 years that they've been going on has never happened. And it was crazy to me to think that we have all of these Indigenous leaders coming, and then we have all of these banking professionals coming, and they're all talking about the same thing, siloed and in completely different spaces. And then we have Earth Day that's not even connected to any of the UN events. So it was my attempt, and I'm just so proud of our teams and everyone from OM, and with your help, we've been able to combine all three of these events this year. So the
Epic.
Financing for Development Forum is meeting with and speaking and bringing together the Indigenous Peoples Forum. We have banking leaders, we have Indigenous leaders on panels together. They're going to be speaking together about solutions, true earth-based solutions. Jarvis's amazing 4 acres earth-based solution. And then also combining all of that with Earth Day and the celebration. So I could not be more proud and more excited to see this year. I'm calling this the year of radical collaboration, and this week truly represents the embodiment of all of them. So I'm just so excited and so proud.
You should be incredibly proud. It's so nice to see your big smile when you remember how amazing you are and how you show up in the world. I'm very, very proud to know you. I mean, this has been such a beautiful conversation, Rebecca. Is there anything you'd like to say that we haven't discussed just quickly, like a quick soundbite?
Yeah, my hope is that people remember that change is not just something we demand, it's really something that we embody, we build, and we can only build together. We can do anything. We are beyond powerful, but not individually, only when we come together. So that is my hope and my prayer for all of us.
I love that. I love that connection. What a conversation. Rebecca, thank you. Not just for your time today, but for the work you're doing in the world. Because what really lands for me, and I'm sure everybody listening, is peace isn't something that happens out there. It isn't a policy or a headline or even a moment in history. It's something we practice. In how we listen, in how we speak, in how we choose to understand each other, especially when it's hard. And in a world that feels increasingly divided, fast and noisy, this idea of heart-centered leadership isn't soft, it's powerful, it's necessary, it's the foundation of everything that comes next. And from classrooms to boardrooms to global decision making, and maybe that's the invitation from you from today's show to slow down just enough to lead with a little more awareness, a little more compassion, and a little more courage to connect. Because if peace starts anywhere, it starts within. Thank you so much, Rebecca. You've been an absolutely delight. I'm looking forward to seeing you in literally, I'm going to get dressed, jump on a train, and I'll be with you as quickly as I can at the UN HQ.
Yes, so exciting. Thank you so much for this opportunity and this beautiful conversation.
No,
It's
it's been
been so
magical. Let's
powerful. Thank you.
have you on again because I know you're doing fantastic work now that you've got this new role. Clearly, you've already managed to do something that nobody's done just by bringing these three or four different elements together for this week. So it just shows the power that you are. So thank you for showing up. This has been a great show. I'd just like to remind you, everybody, that have a wonderful week. Remember that this is Earth Month. There's Earth Day on Wednesday. It's Earth Week in New York. So, be kind, tread lightly, lean into clean, do as much as you can. And on a very personal note, Rebecca mentioned that I've launched this project called 4 Acres. Now, just imagine if you separated every piece of planet, every piece of Earth into all the people, everybody would get about 4 acres. So go to 4acres.com and join the waiting list to get your piece. This has been amazing.